right, this is tape one, side B now. We were talking about hobbies, interests that you had as a child. When you say, you mentioned chorus music, did you play an instrument?
Yeah, I played flute mostly in the orchestra. Yeah.
Okay.
I also took piano lessons, and I dabbled in the saxophone, but flute was sort of the instrument I played in the orchestra. But we also had a chorus that sang, you know, the, you know, Matthew Passions for, you know, and sort of the, you know, and Messiah and, you know, big sort of, you know, choral music for religious holidays and stuff. And,
right.
You know. So it was quite ambitious, what they put on.
Do you still play an instrument now, or have you given
that? Yeah, I mean, I really just pick it up once a week, that kind of thing.
Okay.
I haven't played. In grad school, I still played chamber music, but not really since then. I've really only then I went through a real dip, and now I pull it out just to expose the kids to it a bit.
Yeah.
And that's...
When you're going through elementary school all the way up to high school, were there any influential teachers that you met?
Good question. I mean, there were influential teachers. I mean, really, the most influential teachers were these art teachers. So I had this. I'm not sure if that's really relevant, but I think that this guy. There was a very influential teacher who, but the way he was influential is that he ran a group that met after school and sort of worked on projects, sort of social, political things. And that was a few students, but also former graduates of the school and sort of newly minted university students, a couple of them. And he was sort of interested in what he called, he didn't sell himself as a guy to lead this group, but he was sort of part of the group, but he was sort of intellectually trendsetting, I think. And he called this sort of... action art, and so we do sort of little happenings in the shopping street, you know, on Saturday. So we'd sort of kinds of things we do, you know, is to roll up one of us in a wire mesh and just put him right in Saturday morning on the dump him in the shopping street, completely full of people, and he sort of was untangling himself, you know, and sort of the. No one knew what this guy was doing, and there was sort of a circle forming. People didn't know if they should help him, or because it was very, very strange. You know, sort of in wire mesh, clearly, and you know. And then some of us would be in the group and sort of agitate with sort of, you know, wow, look, I mean, he really tries to. He's uncomfortable. We should help him. And no, it's just a weirdo, so and try to see what kind of things would develop, and you know, we put up it's sort of theater for the 50th anniversary of Hitler's taking power. You know, sort of this was a big event for. Sort of coming to grips with that for Germans in particular,
right.
and you know, people who, fortunately, some people think about that. You know, it's just 50 years ago, we see Rwanda and so on and so forth. But you know, this is really in us, and how did it happen? And so we had a whole bunch of events that we organized. You know, that. You know, try to deal with these issues in sort of a sort of artistic sense, and that was actually quite influential in the sense that I spent a lot of time developing these projects, it's actually a sort of a political street theater that has a long tradition in various in various places, you know, in Brazil and in also in Europe. And
but it kind of reminds me of like Dada in a way too.
Yeah, it is Dada, but it's really much more the texts were really quite political and sensical.
That's true,
and
yeah.
But yeah, the props were sort of Dada, and they were all, you know, very, you know, it's difficult to explain because I really haven't thought about it for a while. But you know, every prop had a sort of very weighty meaning, and
So was this something that you did? I mean, for how long was this? Throughout
a couple, 2 years, perhaps. Okay. Yeah, sort of. Yeah, and sort of. But you know, I was sort of one of the younger members, quite impressionable.
Right.
But it was really quite fun. You know, I got to read a lot of interesting stuff, and there were just a lot of creative people that were part of it, and it had very little to do with science.
That's it.
And, yeah.
Well, and again, this is before college. How much did science sort of impinge on your consciousness?
Well, it did, because I was actually hungry for it. You know, I really, the school that I was in, as may have become obvious, didn't really emphasize that, and the science was always very easy for me, and you know, the math we did was very easy. The physics, you know, I already knew all of that, and I read quite a few sort of biographies, autobiographies, you know, or sort of descriptions of key figures and their discoveries, you know, and nothing particular came to mind. But I, for example, read Heisenberg's autobiography and you know, science, you know, astronomy, astrophysics, stuff. So for the layperson, so I was quite interested in science. And so when I went to college, that is something that I really wanted to pursue, simply because I hadn't been exposed to it. I knew it was very important, very significant. I had very little exposure to it. I had actually relatively little math. I mean, I took all the math we could. But for Germans of secondary education, I had relatively little little background. So compared to many of the people who I who were my contemporaries of freshman year in college, who were seriously interested in science, I was sort of a year behind.
Mm-hmm.
And but I there was really not much of a problem, because you know, you can overcome that relatively quickly.
Right. Now, what you had said earlier is that, you know, these subjects came fairly easily to you. I mean, is that holding true as we get into junior high and high school too?
Yeah.
You didn't have to study very hard.
No, I was very lazy, and I really, and a couple of times actually I had real close calls, because there were some. They asked you to do reports, which just meant essentially handing something in, and I couldn't be bothered doing that, and that was an absolute requirement to actually pass. And so I on a couple of occasions I was excused to allow to sort of to submit something with a significant delay, which was, you know, against the rules, and where, you know, clearly I had mastered the subject, but I was perhaps quite immature actually in terms of discipline.
Right.
And I had much better work habits by the time I was in college.
Getting back to extracurricular activities, was sports important at all?
Yeah, I mean, I've always liked sports. I was never very good at sports, so I played what they call team handball. Again, I was really not very good. I have a lot of slow twitch muscle, So mm-hmm. I've discovered I'm actually a fairly good long-distance runner, but... And I really enjoy a lot of stuff. I play basketball. I actually do a lot of sports now compared to most people, but it's really at a very real hobbyist's level.
Right.
You know, I've run a marathon, but, you know, barely 4 hours. So it's you know, and I'm, you know, I run and I play basketball, I swim, I do all kinds of stuff, but it's... Right. It's really just more to clear the, to reset the brain, you know, mm-hmm. that sort of thing. And actually, I really like the social interactions also. You know, I really don't like running alone. Much more motivated running with three or four friends and shoot the breeze and catch up and right. so on and so forth. It's really has a very important social element for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I have a question too about religion. What impact, if any, did religion have on you and your family?
That's a good question. I've been skeptical about religion, you know, very early on, and my parents never pushed it very hard. Even though my father comes out of from a Catholic family, my parents have actually gotten more religious if they've become older. Not perhaps that unusual, but. My parents actually are different on that front. My mother is really, probably really religious. My father is, you know, quite, I think, more appreciative of the traditions. And he grew up with them and they're meaningful to him. And they're actually meaningful to me more as I grow older. And, you know, that one has to reevaluate all of that stuff now that one has kids. But I think I was an atheist probably by the time I was 12. I mean, not just an agnostic, but had made up my mind.
Right. That's,
yeah.
Okay.
And never tempted, so to speak.
Oh, yeah. And what was your... parents' attitude toward church? I mean, did you have to go to church? Or?
Well, we essentially went to church on occasion on Sundays, and then that, you know, as we became older, they forced the issue less and less, and then even now we still go to church and on Christmas Eve when we visit them, that sort of, you know, core part of the tradition.
Right.
But now they've sort of, they're part of a very liberal Lutheran church, and it's a very different experience than when I was, 10, so Catholic church in Germany or in Czech Republic. It's, mm-hmm. of course, a much more strict affair, and... much more difficult, actually, to become part of and to sort of feel part of, I think.
Mm-hmm. And, do you believe that science and religion are compatible? Or can you be a good scientist and also be a believer in a deity, I guess?
Absolutely. I mean, there are lots of examples that prove that point.
Mm-hmm.
Do I think that they're intellectually compatible? I think no. But... you know, and there are, of course, many definitions of, you know, what religion may or may not be. But I think if you, the question is it religion that is incompatible with natural law in some sense, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that something that can violate natural law. And I think there, I mean, I've known actually a professor who Sharu named unnamed, but he's a Mormon and a very, very good atomic physicist, right? I mean, this guy measures essentially his scientific goal is essentially to test the fundamental laws of nature to sort of 10 orders of precision.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, he's part of this very strange belief system that seems to me completely incompatible, but he's clearly a good scientist and he's a believer, so what can you do?
Yeah. Right.
It wouldn't work for me, but it's certainly possible.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people, you know, need religion, of course, to just sort of for their own stability, right? To sort of put everything into context and so on. And there might be a strong psychological dimension to it. I mean, that's how I sort of rationalize it. But it's there are lots of people, of course, who draw great and impressive strength from religion, and I think that's a perfectly fine way to do it.
Right. Now, as you're finishing up high school, 12th grades, and I don't know the German system, so you can correct me. Yeah. But how would you assess your education in that system?
Well, it's compatible to essentially the high school, a reasonable high school in the yeah. U.S. Of course, in the U.S., the system is very heterogeneous, mm-hmm. and
right. In your high school years, do you feel that your parents had any expectations about you going to college or about what direction your life might take?
Yeah, that's they must have had expectations, but it's not clear that they certainly didn't think that I'd be a scientist, I think, because you know, that wasn't part of their experience. And that whole tradition, from both sides of the family, there's sort of a very strong practical bent, you know, and sort of science is a bit on the impractical end. And so they certainly don't have any problems with me. I mean, of course, they're now, you know, very much proud of what I'm doing and so on and so forth. But I think they were at some point, they were like, well, you know, why not do this kind of thing working for DuPont or something like that? These kinds of, well, there was a little bit of a disconnect. But going back actually to, you really asked about high school, actually. And so I actually don't know what they they were certainly expecting me to go to college and or to university and to but I don't think they had any particular expectations of what I would end up doing.
Right. So, how did you know that there was the expectation you'd go to college?
Oh, that's a good question. I couldn't point to any one thing, but that was fairly standard in both of our families. I mean, it's not even my mother and her siblings were already expected to go. This is sort of a generational move where they sort of in the Prague family, you know, virtually everyone got a higher education. Right. So sort of they were fairly well educated as a sort of clan, and my grandparents from Moravia, they were also well educated, and they just, I mean, education was very important.
Okay. Right?
That was
part of the family tradition,
yeah,
really.
That's right, yeah. on both sides.
Okay, when high school is about to finish up, what directions, what possibilities were you looking at? Where to go to college and what you
right.
study?
Yeah, I mean, so of course I came to the U.S. I applied to a few places, and I I think the way it started is that if I look back, I really had a sense of so there was this political streak that I had, or have perhaps, but that drove me to I think I probably came to college thinking I would be doing some kind of engineering or applied science or something like that. So I felt that was probably a very good way to make a difference. And really then I But I was interested in lots of things. I actually took a lot of writing classes in college. But I think then what really happened is when I started taking serious science stuff, which were these honors classes in physics and chemistry, I really just liked it, you know. And again, it came relatively easy, and the professors were fantastic. I was an undergrad at Cornell. It was really a fantastic place to be an undergrad because... Mm. There were lots of undergrads. They took undergrads pretty seriously. I was an undergrad in physics, and the physics department was very, very good. And I didn't even know it when I went to Cornell, but in hindsight, it was really a very, very good place. And I still have friends there, faculty friends who knew me from there, and there were a couple of individuals who really took an interest in undergraduates, and it was a very, very rich experience.
Mm-hmm. Why Cornell? Why Cornell in particular?
Oh, you know, I just applied there and got in. Basically, I had sort of checkered transcript, fairly good SAT scores, and I think I probably would have gone to MIT if I had gotten in. I didn't. That's a place that I remember I was rejected, and you know, I got into Cornell and UPenn or something like that, and they both had sort of strong engineering schools, and
right.
Yeah, but I just like Cornell.
Had you been to the US before?
Yeah. So, okay. Yeah, I visited those places, of course.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Okay.
Right, so...
Had you been there often? Have you been in
no,
there?
No, 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 no.
Okay.
Yeah, so I've been an exchange student in 10th grade, and then.
That's, okay. All right, you said that when you get to Cornell, this is when you have really your first... Well, you didn't say this, but I'm assuming this, that you had your first sort of laboratory experience.
Yeah, I mean, so that came even later. Now you're talking about research, right? So first, I mean, I had my first real, I would call it science education, right? I mean, that is worth remembering. I mean, I could have probably skipped everything. Mm-hmm. That we'd done in, I mean, probably I learned more just reading sort of, popular science than I learned in high school. But I think I learned a lot of, the process of thinking about science, about using mathematics and science. The power of mathematics became really clear to me. You know, I took a lot of math, and I don't really took as much math as I could until I really stopped understanding what they were teaching. You know, I had to sort of find my way because I was quite inexperienced. And so the first thing that attracted me were sort of mathematical things. But then, in the end, the lack of, sort of abstract math sort of is dissociated. I always have this sort of practical streak, and it's sort of quite dissociated from any applications. And so... That stopped being less satisfying than physics, and that's what I really focused on. And then they had a work study program, which was essentially part of my financial aid package was to work 20 hours a week. And so the first year I worked in a library, but then I figured out that you could actually work in a lab, that professors would essentially, they'd only have to pay a small fraction of your salary. It was just like $5 an hour, but they'd pay only $1.50, and the rest came from the state or something like that. I don't remember. And so then from then on I worked in labs, and that was actually very, very important. I didn't do much the first year, just sort of helped out, and then some computer programming, and then some electronics, you know, very just sort of by osmosis picked up sort of the doing of science in a number of labs, actually well-known labs. And that was very, very useful. You just got the sense, it was a very vibrant place, and you got the sense that this was actually not just very interesting, but also fun.
Mm-hmm.
The students were excited about what they were doing. They, you know, they all had sort of rich lives, and so that part of it. And then a very important thing was I got a summer job at Bell Labs right after my first, as a sort of programmer at Bell Laboratories, right, which was very, very important, because I actually worked there for 4 summers.
Mm.
And two in a sort of statistics group where I did mostly programming. And so I learned a lot and was really part of a research effort. So my code was used in some, you know, software toolbox and so on. So it was really, you know, you can be pretty serious about it. And then later on in a basic physics research lab, and where I did experiments for the summer. They had the summer program, which was very hard to get into, but I got my foot in as a sort of sideways, right, because I sort of started as a programmer, and then I sort of learned about who does what, and then I approached them directly and said, next summer, can I come to your lab? And,
mm-hmm.
And that was, you know, that was important also.
So this was all while you were an undergrad then?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So and they paid money, and it was great. You know, I had to finance part of my although my parents obviously supported me quite a bit, but they weren't really prepared to, you know, this is incredibly expensive, these private universities. So sure. You know, I could make $5,000 in the summer and do really very, very interesting things.
Mm-hmm. Does any of that research you did over the summers, I mean, what stands out? Are there any projects that were memorable?
Yeah, I mean, it's so first of all, like in after my sophomore year, you know, the research I did, that was sort of the first paper that I was on. But, you know, it was just real research. So where there was a problem, and you had a set of equations, and you had to solve them. And then down the hall was someone who was really good at that. You went talk to them. They'd give you references to read, and then you'd go into depth. And this is sort of applied math and statistics. So really all about reliability testing. How do you extrapolate to normal conditions for failures for computer chips and stuff like that, that you test at extreme conditions, because you want to design things that last 30 years, but you don't want to test them for 30 years. So right. There are this whole field of reliability testing is very complicated extrapolation procedures, essentially, based on physical models of what the failure process would be.
Is this? I'm sorry. Is this connected with this paper, statistical kinetic model?
Exactly.
Okay.
Right.
Good. Yeah, yeah.
So how did you dig that up? Yeah.
That was in your actually your application, your Pew application.
I think. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. Yeah.
So that was your first paper then.
Well, yeah, and there, of course, it was mostly the stuff that Mike Leval, one of the authors, did, but you know, I did a little piece of that. Yeah.
Right.
Okay. I mean, historically, the first. It may not have been the first that was published.
Yeah.
But then, so I had these great jobs also at Cornell, and then another important thing was I actually had acquired enough credits that I was able to do a semester at Lawrence Berkeley Lab, and namely there was the DOE was funding this sort of semester research program, and I could do that because I had taken enough classes to graduate, and so I went to Berkeley for a semester and did another really was a very important stint for me, where I worked in a physics lab pretty much full time. Mm-hmm. And that was very exciting because this was a lab that was focusing, that really was in the midst of working on high-TC superconductors, which was a very important discovery. Do you know about that?
I don't.
No, so it's not biology, but sort of in the late 80s, these guys discovered that completely new, and then they, Bednarz and Müller, they won the Nobel Prize like 2 or 3 years later. It was very, very important and to generate incredibly exciting. A completely new class of materials could be superconducting, that is, conductive.
I did hear that. Yeah. I do remember that.
And the mechanisms were unclear, and it was actually, since these things were conducting at high temperatures, the experiments were relatively easy. So an undergrad could actually do, fairly nice experiments. And it turns out that I actually didn't work on high-TC superconductors directly, but on something related. But the whole lab, it was just very exciting. This was in Alex Zettel's lab at Berkeley. And so, that was a place where you have put together experiments, with rubber bands and tape and wires and all kinds of things. And they, where an undergrad could really get involved, and it was a lot of fun. And that it became clear that I wanted to try to do science. I mean, even though, it was pretty clear that not everyone, that would still be a long road.
Yeah. Okay. Sort of non-science questions, but maybe important ones nonetheless. What about your extracurricular activities again? What are you doing outside of the classroom, I guess, when you're at Cornell? Or are you really focusing?
Let's see. So,
did you belong to clubs?
Yeah, what did I do? Did I belong to any clubs? I mean, I belong to clubs that sort of intramural sports teams, that kind of thing. Would of course go to lots of events, and there were some sort of political things that were sort of relatively minor. But I actually really think that was sort of a time where I really took advantage of the university as sort of as the academy, and that really just libraries and courses and learning how to write. That's something that I really learned. I mean, I think I learned how to write there, which I notice, writing papers with postdocs of mine. It's really happy I did. I took expository writing classes, quite a few, and sort of, classes that were designed to teach you skills in writing essays and so on. So I took a lot of courses, sort of, at least five courses a semester.
Right.
And I have lots of friends from there. We had of course the usual sort of fun and so on. But I can't remember any. Didn't do anything sort of. I didn't play any organized sport beyond intramural sort of clubs, which was we never practiced. We just sort of
showed up.
Yeah, winged it, and so all kinds of stuff: squash and running and soccer and basketball, but all very modest level.
Right.
So.
And what was your social life like?
Oh, I have tons of friends and girlfriends and all that kind of stuff. I mean, it was very rich. I was never part of what they call the Greek scene with these sororities. And that was fairly strong, and I don't think I ever was at a frat party. And I actually met my wife there, but, you know, very briefly, and we bumped into each other, you know, 5 years later in Cambridge when we were both grad students at Harvard. But
it's amazing.
The first time I glimpsed her was at Cornell.
Right? Had you been formally introduced? Or
Yeah, sure. Okay. We knew each other, yeah. But we didn't keep in touch. So.
Right. So it would seem then, if you were assessing your education at Cornell, that it was rich. You just
it was very, very rich. Yeah, I think in hindsight I really made a lot of it. I think it was really, you know, very. I learned a lot and just made great connections and it was very good.
Okay. In sort of evaluating your development as a scientist, it seems to me that, is the way you describe it, you're learning almost as much outside of Cornell, really, with these summer jobs and this trip to Berkeley,
right,
as you are within its walls.
Absolutely, yeah, and it's almost complementary, because the work-study stuff was important to get me exposed to different things, but it's very difficult, you know, when you're taking a full load of courses to, you know, in like 15, 20 hours a week to really get anything done. First of all, it's not a long time, but also you're whipped, you know, and you're sort of cutting corners, because it's, if you have 5 courses, homework, and all that kind of stuff, and a social life, then you sort of just show up and do the minimum. But it was important to get exposed to, you know, the excitement of doing science and, you know, going to group meetings and things like that where people discuss projects and all. But I think the opportunities to do stuff myself were mostly during the summers and during that semester in Berkeley.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like a cohesive project.
Yeah.
It's really good stuff, yeah.
So you graduate, you get your degree in physics, your BA at Cornell, and then you head out to Kathmandu in Nepal.
Right.
And describe why you ended there.
Well, that was really, that's an interesting, that was very, I was already accepted to grad schools, and I chose to go to Harvard for various reasons, because I was interested in biophysics, and my last semester at Cornell, I sort of explored that a bit. I just deferred, and it turns out that there was a friend of mine from high school who was Nepalese, and through her I found out that there was a possibility to perhaps help out with some teaching in Kathmandu, and that's what I did. You know, I just said, well, let's do something else for a year, and I worked in this school in Kathmandu. For a few months, really, only because it was a physics teacher who had fallen sick with hepatitis and basically took his spot.
Mm-hmm.
Taught, you know, sort of A-level physics. And, you know, then traveled a bit, did some trekking and went around India and then came back, basically. Mm-hmm.
With every intention of, I mean, like you say, you had already been accepted at Harvard.
Right. Okay. Every intention to come back. There was no question about that, yeah.
Right. And when you were applying to graduate schools, you get in at Harvard. Where else did you apply?
Oh, let's see. Where else did I apply? I applied to Berkeley, and probably the only reason I didn't go there is because I had already been there.
Mm-hmm.
I was tempted to go to Santa Barbara because they had a very good... another topic that I was interested in was fluid dynamics, sort of classical physics. But then some wise people talked me out of going to Santa Barbara, because although everyone agreed that for the particular thing I was interested in, it was very good, that it... was a bit unwise to go to a place like that. It was a bit spotty in, right, otherwise. And you know, I may have applied to two or three other places, but I just can't remember. Okay. Yeah, but I was, at that point, with all the experiences I had, I was pretty much accepted everywhere, but I just can't, right now I can't remember. I may have applied to Stanford, but yeah.
Well, you accepted Harvard, and I mean, there's obviously the Harvard name, clearly,
yeah, right.
But were there other things that attracted you?
Yeah, no, it was really the biophysics program. So the physics I was interested in was, again, this sort of more classical in the sense that it's not quantum mechanical, but this was sort of fairly complicated statistical mechanics and fluid dynamics. And that was very strong. There was a guy who I ended up working with for a while there, David Nelson, who I don't think I ever wrote a paper with, but was there, who was sort of sort of the best guy in the field. And there's a Harvard name that didn't really play such a big role for me. As I said, I probably would have gone to Berkeley if I hadn't been there. Berkeley is probably equally famous. But but the really strong biophysics program also attracted me. So they have this, they had a relatively early biophysics program that was mostly about structural biology, but where they tried to draw physics students into biology. That's what I actually ended up being in.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, of course, an incredibly broad and rich university. It's I had a fantastic time as a graduate student. It was really very rich, but I think as a it was not uniformly so. It probably wasn't the best place to be a grad student.
Mm-hmm.
The situation I got myself into was very good, but it has changed a bit since then, but it was still sort of the old Harvard, where there were lots of big professors who rarely interacted, and who there were sort of empires and lots of politics, and not really the kinds of thing that students really flourish in, right? Where there's students sort of flourish more in places where there's a lot of interactions, lots of collaborations, and so on. But anyways, I really liked it.
Mm-hmm.
For other reasons.
Okay. Let me change the